You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 31st of March, 2012, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brûlé, and Hugo MacDonald.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll find out what books have sold well this week from a trio of independent booksellers in Berlin, New York, and Fairbanks in Alaska.
I was sitting with a friend many years ago trying to decide what to name the bookstore. Gulliver's Travels was on the shelf, and from that came Gulliver's Books.
That was Dave Hollingsworth from Gulliver's Books in Fairbanks. We'll also be heading to Australia for today's music review with a DJ from Triple J, Linda Magliano.
And we'll be flicking through the pages of our favourite magazines with the grande dame of interiors journalism, Lucia van der Post.
All that and much more right here on The Review on Monocle 24. Hello and good afternoon from Studio One here at Midori House. I'm Tyler Brûlé with my dear colleague Hugo MacDonald.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm very well. I can't hear myself in my headphones at all, so you just sort of sound muffled. Oh, there I am.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. It's fine.
That's better.
It would have been interesting doing the show that way.
Guess what I'm saying from my lips.
Exactly. What do you have there for us?
I've got the front cover of the FT Weekend, where there is a big picture of the
Shard. Is that a segue? Because Lucia van der Post is coming on later.
Yes, it is. Exactly.
That's good.
But the Shard has had its fine. The Shard is Renzo Piano's large building in London Bridge in South London.
Is that a cue for me to ask what you think of it?
Yeah, that's what I was hoping.
What do you think of it, Hugo?
I don't like it very much.
No.
It's
out of context.
Oh, it's totally out of context, and it's just been plonked. But there's no consideration to the infrastructure in that area, which is choked enough as it is without however many 100,000 people that are going to be...
Do you think, though, would it have worked architecturally if they had... Because it does remind you of the Transamerica building in one of your favourite cities in the world, which is San Francisco.
Yes.
So if they had put it in the city of London or if it sat out in Docklands, would it have worked?
It would have definitely made more sense in Canary Wharf. But in the heart of the city and, you know, with all those really beautiful old sort of Victorian industrial buildings, it just sticks out like a sore thumb.
And what about in isolation, though, as a building, just on its own, architecturally, the merit of Renzo Piano?
I mean, it's impressive. And even when you stand underneath the Shard and you look up at it, it's an incredible structure.
Right.
Feat of engineering. Personally, I'm not a huge fan of massive steel and glass constructions. I prefer sort of wood.
Okay.
And brick.
as we well know. Just on the cover of the Herald Tribune this morning, there's a piece about headline is Starbucks tries once again to win Europeans over. And this just seems to be an ongoing story. It's yet another reinvention of Starbucks. And the Stanford in the story says lackluster sales lead it to redesign shops, adjust recipes and blends. And it's something that we've covered in the magazine quite a bit. Also, what Starbucks has been trying to do. Do you think does it get to a point now? Because... You know, I think one of the big challenges in the UK is that your business model works very well in Cincinnati or even San Francisco, potentially, where real estate prices are a little bit lower. But in London, where they're so crazy expensive and they've got three on every block, and they only make money from, what, eight in the morning till just after midday, maybe?
Yeah.
You might nip out for coffee, you know, up until two, no?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, depending on...
But I think that's the big challenge. And I know that they're looking at liquor licenses and all kinds of different things to make them work. But
yeah, but they've been trying to reinvent themselves so often.
Right.
Also, I think these stories, you just get a bit tired and you begin to think, is there real problems for them here in this market?
And does it get to a point that you think they just have to pack up and go home? Because that's just interesting. That's what happened in Australia. I think there's nine there's just a handful of Starbucks left. We can ask the gentleman from Triple J who we're going to be talking to later. But Sorry? Oh, yes, it is a lady, pardon me. I tend to think of Triple J DJs as men, anyway.
Okay, well, Linda is a woman.
We can punch that out later.
Yeah.
No, but in Australia, it was almost that they retreated from that market because they've got a symbolic presence, probably for all of the cruise ships that come in.
Mm. And it's interesting, actually, you mentioned San Francisco, but I'm not sure that they're that huge in San Francisco anymore.
That's right, because everyone knows exactly what they're doing in San Francisco. I forgot that. We see how many times we can say San Francisco in this program. And isn't it remarkable about, 90 centimeters above our head, there's just a hive of activity because we finished the May issue.
Finishing.
But I feel it's finished because the wall. Which
well, you've
is
done
where
your bit.
I haven't done my bit. As soon as we get off air, I've got another 3 pages to write.
Okay.
But that's kind of, I mean, most of the cake is baked. This is just...
it's an amazing issue. It's huge.
Yeah. And it's because normally at this time of year, issues tend to get a little bit smaller when you get closer to them. And then we have, of course, a big double issue. But this is a beast. Mm, we've got 36 pages from Thailand. How big is your design directory?
36 pages.
36 pages.
24 pages on Helsinki.
Yeah. And we've got a 12-page special on design in Hong Kong. It's a beast.
It's amazing though when you see it finally go up on the wall and there's been this flurry of activity in the last couple of days.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, anyway, you are listening to the review on Monocle 24.
Yes, you are.
In a moment, our regular rummage through the bookshops from around the world. But first, a short break.
Anyway, we start today, as ever, with a trio of bookshops from around the world to hear what's been selling over the past week.
First up, we visit Dialogue Books in Berlin.
Hi, I'm Charmaine Lovegrove, and I'm the founder of Dialogue Books, which is a boutique English language bookshop in Kreuzberg in Berlin, situated in the Grafer Keats area. So our bookshop is a small boutique bookshop which has 3,000 titles. The idea behind it is that it feels like a home library and is really accessible with a range of titles that I believe that people who want to have a perfect English language home library should have. So we first of all explore nonfiction. And we look at theory, and theory is cultural studies, art theory, philosophy. Then we move into anything that people lived through, such as and wrote about, such as biography, politics, history. And then we move into our fiction, or kind of anything that people made up. So that's fiction, which is generally literary fiction. It's also plays and poetry. And we move through the different continents of the world for our fiction section. So we start with Africa, Asia, Australasia. We move into the Eastern European areas, the UK, Latin America and the Caribbean, the Middle East and North America. The bookshop's called Dialogue because I feel that books inhabit not just a place on our desk or in our bag. You know, it's a private thing that you do as reading, but I also feel that it should inhabit an open space and a forum for dialogue. And so part of that, we host a range of really fantastic events using different locations around the city, as well as our bookshop. We've had people like Claire Massoud and Chris Adrian and Jonathan Coe. And last week we had Tom McCarthy, which was intellectually was an absolutely fantastic event. We just had a big sale, so we're about to do a big restock of the shop. And I think I'm just really interested in us looking more at different regions. So especially sort of Middle Eastern writing, Caribbean, Latin American, African, especially. I think I want to sort of offer something a bit different. So we're going to have less of British writing and more American classics, and then opening up those areas. In our window, we've got a typewriter, which is always really funny because the amount of kids that come in to the bookshop and they're like, what is that? And it's really amazing. You know, they really don't know what a typewriter is. And it makes you realise how fast things are changing. And then obviously we have some books in the window, so you can see what we're really into. And I think at the moment we have some Gerhard Richter, we have Steven Pinker. There's a couple of theory books, and I think there probably is The Pale King as well by David Foster Wallace.
That was Charmaine Lovegrove from Dialogue Books in Berlin.
Are you tempted to jump on an Air Berlin flight and go shop this afternoon?
Yeah, I am actually. Yeah. Well,
you like Berlin.
I like Berlin. I haven't been for a while, but yeah.
Would you like to go soon? I think we should do something for July, August there.
In Berlin?
Yeah, I think there's some very good stories to be done.
Yeah, and actually a story that is a little bit different from the story that everybody else is telling about Berlin.
Yeah, and well, and just the, you can see all, when I flew in a couple of weeks ago, there's just, you see well, the ice was coming off the lakes in and around the city, and just all of those just great little Schreber Garden houses and everything. Yeah. So I think there's a, we can send you around the lakes.
And I'll go and say hello to Charmaine.
On a bike.
Yeah.
Next up, we are heading to Alaska, to Fairbanks, to be exact, to Gulliver's Books.
My name is David Hollingsworth, and I own Gulliver's Books in Fairbanks, Alaska. I was sitting with a friend many years ago trying to decide what to name the bookstore. Gulliver's Travels was on the shelf, and from that came Gulliver's Books. There are more than books here. There's always been more than books here. We sell a lot of games. We sell gifts of all kinds, some really crazy funny things like farting fingers, which is actually a pen. We also have used books, and in the marketplace as it's changing, we need to have those things in order to make up for the sales that we don't have because they're going to ebooks or they're going to Amazon or something like that. So we continue to try to find the right mix that keeps us profitable. Hunger Games is probably the most popular book in the store right now since the movie just came out. We always sell Alaska books very well. We're probably the best store for Alaska books in the whole country. We have a huge selection, probably over 2,500 different titles. So we get known for that. Most people come in who haven't been in before, they act surprised sometimes because there's so much here. I've heard that comment so many times. Oh, I have heard about this place. I had no idea. It's so much fun to be here. And I hope that's what they feel when they come in. Often the new people are a little surprised at how much there is, and then they look around at the downstairs, and then I tell them, well, all the used books are upstairs. And they kind of look at me sometimes and go, you mean there's more? I said, oh, yeah, and there's a cafe up there, too. And if you want a free cup of coffee or you want free Wi-Fi, that's all upstairs. I think it feels warm. It is colorful. There's lots of different things here. I don't know. It feels a little bit homey, I think. Some people refer to Gulliver's as an institution in Fairbanks. And I look at them a little funny sometimes and go, well, there's different meanings for the word institution. And after I've been here 50 hours in a week, I will agree it's quite an institution. At the same time, we're a place that people meet. I've had kids who came in here and kind of grew up as this was their bookstore for years. Well, guess what? A couple of them have actually started working for me, you know, and I knew their parents before they were even born. And just to kind of be that part of the community that you connect with a family all the way through that, you know, or a child all the way through their whole growing up time. I am proud of my bookstore. It's been my life.
And that was Dave Hollingsworth from Gulliver's Books in Fairbanks. What a lovely voice.
Oh, I know. I like the farting pen. Single-handedly rescuing bookstores around the world.
I can get you a whole pot of them if you want.
Well, now we head to New York to speak to the owner of Three Lives and Company in Greenwich Village, Manhattan.
I'm Toby Cox, the owner of Three Lives and Company, a neighborhood bookshop here in the West Village, Greenwich Village, New York. Three Lives was started by three women back in 1978, and they were riffing on the three of them that opened the shop, and they were probably all in their mid-20s at that time, and the Gertrude Stein novel, Three Lives. They were in one location for 5 years, then they moved into the current location back in 1983. It was an old corner store, and they built it out using lots of nice natural wood and green globe lamps and lots of space for books. They crammed it full of shelves and lots of face-outs, so the books really get to present themselves. This store is about the book. We are primarily literary fiction and narrative nonfiction, so some biography, some history, current event a little bit, but our focus is fiction. A good story, well told. Nathan Englander's second short story collection, what we talk about when we talk about Anne Frank, it's been very popular, a couple here mad for it. Very rich storytelling. He's quite something, and people have responded. He's been very popular. In nonfiction, the Jeanette Winterson, Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal, her memoir, just out 2 weeks, maybe less. has been a huge bestseller for us. Front page in the New York Times Book Review has helped, but reads in-house have been phenomenal. And lastly, Catherine Boo, Behind the Beautiful Forevers, her account of a slum in Mumbai, reads like fiction, this nonfiction, her account of 4 years spent with these people in this slum. The store has sustained itself, I think, from the very beginning as a place for people to come and share their passion with books. And everyone who's ever worked in the Three Lives is an avid reader, not only loves to read, but loves to talk about it and share it. And we often learn as much from our customers as they may learn from us.
And that was Toby Cox, owner of Three Lives and Company in New York. Have you been?
To New York?
Well, not to New York. We know you've been to New York, but have you been to that bookshop?
No,
before?
I haven't. No, I like the idea of it.
Do you have any favorite bookstores in New York?
No. You put me on the spot there. What's yours, Tyler? That's what radio's all about. I know. What's yours?
I do like McNally Jackson.
McNally Jackson, I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, because she's from Winnipeg.
Okay, that's nice.
Yeah. We didn't go to the same school.
Predictable. Next on the review, we head to Australia to hear what's hot.
Oh, your favourite country.
What's hot in the world of music? Stay with us.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, wants to beckon you onto its intergalactic spaceship of artistic endeavour, zooming you from gallery openings on Mars to concerts on Venus via magazine launches on the outer reaches of the Milky Way. Actually, that's a lie, but it is a truly global mix of art, literature, film, music, media, and the home of the wonderful and well-loved showcase for live music, the Midori House Sessions.
In the backs of buses across Europe and Latin America, we composed a little song.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time. The Globalist bids good night to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia, with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run-through of the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
There's a lot of money in this country. It's a very strong economy, and it's really growing rapidly, and so it's the natural choice.
Wake up in Europe to The Globalist, live every weekday at 6 a.m. London time, here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Tyler Brulé.
And it's now time for a weekly music review. And today we focus on Australia. On the phone from Sydney, we have Linda. Now, Linda, there's a whole discussion about your last name. It was just whispered in my ear that it's Mariano, or is it Marigliano?
Well, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very good. I'm very good. I'm talking to you from the future. It's Saturday night here in Sydney. But from the future, I can tell you that my last name is spelt Marigliano. It is Italian, so it's meant to be Marigliano. You know, you've got to really say it with that accent, but I totally cheat and I just say Mariano.
Okay. Good. All right. Well, we had it. I think we had it right on all levels. And Hugo was pronouncing it with complete Italian flair earlier on.
Oh, good.
Which is much better than the fact that I referred to you as a guy. But anyway, we've got everything squared away now.
How could you get Linda wrong as a guy?
I know. It wasn't that. My mind was on Triple J, and I was just thinking about DJs, and I don't know. I'm sorry.
I'm pretty masculine. It's okay.
What's happening in Sydney tonight?
Well, at the moment, I'm sitting in my home, but there's, you know, it's bustling as always. I was living in London up until the start of January, so I've come back to Sydney, and it's absolutely chock-a-block with gigs and new clubs and new bars that are opening up with weird little hole-in-the-wall venues. Like a couple of weeks ago, I was sitting in an old bombed-out news agency that someone just turned into this new venue. And so there's these great little scenes that are kind of popping up everywhere. And this weekend, there was a great showcase that was on last night at a club in Sydney called Good God, where if you know that LA record label run by Diplo, Mad Decent?
I know Diplo. I don't know Mad Decent.
Yeah, well, Mad Decent is this record label that he runs, but there's an arm of it here in Sydney that kind of gets a whole bunch of, I suppose you call them kind of like underprivileged kids from, you know, whether they're in the sticks of Australia or whether they're from the cities, and they kind of give them this opportunity to produce new music. And then last night they put on this massive gig where a whole bunch of these kids just got to go into a club and play what they had been making. And it's, you know, it's really nice. There's this really nice sense of community for people that are professional and people that are just starting out that are super young, you know.
So thriving sort of underground club scene then, by the sounds of things.
Yeah, yeah. It's really, really lovely, and it's refreshing as well.
Yeah, very much so. Is it more exciting than what's happening in London, do you think?
I couldn't really compare. I mean, Sydney is, I think, as good as it has ever been. Like, because I lived in London for 3 years, and I think when I moved away from Sydney, it was because, to me, it felt like it was almost going through a bit of a down patch. Like, there wasn't as much stuff going on, and all of my friends that were in the music scene and all of us DJs were all kind of, we'd all kind of stopped going out, it seemed. But now I've come back here and it's like all of these people and people like me went overseas, saw stuff that we were really influenced by and have come back to Sydney or, you know, to Melbourne or Brisbane and have started putting on these club nights or these weird live music nights that have just kind of started off. So like a couple of friends of mine started a new club night called Motoric, which is completely influenced by the Berghain techno night in Berlin.
It's one of my favourite nights. I love it though.
Yeah, so it's really weird, but it's kind of amazing. It's, you know, we're so far away from the rest of the world that we've kind of got to really make our own scene work, because we can't just get on a plane or get on the Eurostar and jump to Paris or jump to Berlin if there's a great club night on. We've got to make it happen here for ourselves.
But do you think part of the exciting thing as well is that it is just that sense of isolation, but also that the barrier for entry is so much lower in Sydney? And I mean that in a positive way, that, you know, so to start up and do something, and that's what I just noticed, not so much on the club scene, but just the amount and the way they've changed the licensing laws now in Sydney for bar operators. And there's just so many young people, and they're young owner operators, as opposed to, you know, in London, so frequently you have to have big money behind you to do something.
Oh, exactly. That's the thing. Like, all the bars that we're going to these days, like I said, like that place that was a news agency that just kind of got overrun, and so a couple of kids just, you know, pulled the paint off the walls, took down the old Women's Weekly and Playboy, you know, magazine posters, and have turned it into a venue. And there's all these weird little hole-in-the-wall bars that have opened up and venues, and it's totally due to that licensing. The fact that it's more relaxed means that people are actually getting out there that don't have a crap load of money that can start putting on nights, and it creates that weird developing scene, you know? You don't want to have to go out and spend heaps of money to see a cool new DJ. Like, that's the whole point.
Absolutely. Listen, why don't we have a first song? I think you've lined up Flume by Sleepless featuring Antony and Cleopatra. Let's have a listen first and we can chat about it off the back. And that was Flume by Sleepless featuring Antony for Cleopatra. And we're chatting to Linda Mariano from Triple J. Amongst other things, I would imagine as well, you've got many other gigs and things going on. At least that was the briefing that I was told before we went on air. Besides what you're doing with Triple J, what else keeps you busy across the week?
I DJ as well. So I've come back. Oh, we've been launching this. The show that I present on Triple J is weeknights, and it's called Good Nights. And so it's basically a new music show. It's international new music and Australian new music. So in amongst that, I book in DJ sets that kind of fall into line with that. So lots of party music, but with a focus on new music as well. So I've got kind of gigs lined up for around Australia, which is really nice, and then some other freelance presenting too. So keeping busy, always, you know, like everybody else in the music scene, just constantly scouring the internet and finding what next new thing we're all being, you know, being thrown back for.
I wonder, just, it's interesting because of the, Triple J is of course, part of the ABC, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And, but it doesn't matter, you know, who you are as a broadcaster, there's always content rules that govern how much Aussie output there is. So what is it a bit of a dilemma when you're doing a show which is largely international? Do you still have, what is it, 30% you have to play, something like that, that's Aussie content?
I think it's about a quarter that has to be Australian. So with my show, it's fairly lenient in terms of what new music releases we want to play and we want to showcase. Luckily, Australia is, I think, in a really good place musically at the moment that there is so much new music output, so I'm actually more than happy to fill that quota. And I think we probably actually go over that quota most nights with showcasing artists like who you just heard, Flume, and, you know, plenty of other new bands, and there seems to be a lot of new bands and new producers that are coming out too, so I'm kind of always eager to give them a leg up and play them and see what people think of them.
Linda, should we move on to your next recommendation? This is Hyper Paradise by Hermitude. That was Hyper Paradise by Hermitude. I liked that. Thank you, Linda.
Oh, you're welcome.
I like the first one. I like the first one better.
You like the first one? Well, it's weird because Hermitude have been around for years, so they're super experienced, you know, kind of two producers that have been around. But the first one, which was Sleepless by Flume, Flume is 19 years old. That's his first release ever.
Wow.
Which I think is pretty amazing because it's super classy sounding. It sounds like someone that's been making beats for a long time, but
that's what I was saying. Hugo was being quite damning of the song, but
I was saying that it reminds me of something that would be playing in a nightclub at 6 in the morning as the lights were coming up and everybody was beginning to kind of hate themselves for still being out.
Yeah, totally. Everybody loves that song. That's the get the hell out of here.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't let anybody see you in daylight. Get home. Don't let the cab driver rip you off. Don't leave your debit card with the cab driver.
Don't forget to pick up your coat on the way out.
Especially a Sydney cab.
Oh, I know. Super dodgy. We're so dodgy down here.
I wanted to ask you, just going back to Triple J and the ABC, as you said, it's pretty lenient, you know, what you're able to play. And it was interesting you said that your research is largely web-based. But your relationship, though, you're also working for, you know, a major network public service broadcaster. Do you still have to keep up relationships, you know, with the PRs for all of the major labels? Does that still play a role for you or not really?
To be honest, it doesn't really so much. I mean, it does in that we see them very often and that they come and they pester us to play their songs. But we're kind of, I guess at Triple J, we're kind of a bit smart alecky about it. Like, we get given a shitload of stuff and then we kind of go, oh, well, we like that. No, we don't like that. Just because Triple J is the sort of place that has been around for so many decades, so I guess our music director has that leverage to say whether we want to champion something or whether we don't, which is lucky.
Absolutely. Linda Mugliani, we're going to have to leave it there.
Oh, well, look, have a fantastic day. Thanks for calling me.
Not at all. And we'll look forward to seeing you up in London. Or, well, you know, of course, you know, we would love to come back. But I guess, is it getting cozy down in Sydney right now? I mean, obviously, summer is drawing to a close. But, you know, your summer runs a little bit longer than ours. We just had an amazing week in London.
We've had a bit of a crappy summer, to be honest. It's not been as swelteringly balmy as I would have liked it to have been. But it always runs a little bit longer than you think. And today was lovely. I went for a swim at 5 o'clock.
Oh. Lucky you, Linda.
Well, listen, we'll
it's okay. We'll jump into what Hampstead bathing pool.
Not today. It's just started to get colder again.
It's a bit yucky. Well, listen, we'll catch up very soon. Thank you for that. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Bye. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. When we come back, we have our stack of favourite magazines and Lucia Vanderpost is here. We're back after this.
The April issue of Monocle is something of a vote winner, as we look at the power of parliaments from Europe's high north Sami HQ to Addis Ababa's new gathering place for the African Union. We also limber up for our Olympic series as we head out on the Tigris with Iraq's rowing team. Then there's a look at doing business in Wellington and a frothy soap story from Portugal. And our editors have lots more to offer too. In the business section this month, we'll head down under to New Zealand's small but perfectly formed capital, Wellington. With a comparatively tiny domestic market, this Antipodean David is taking on the Goliath task of creating knowledge-enriched services and products that compete on a global level. We also head to Kentucky to review the Farm Machinery Show with Plough Factor and look at the Canadian food retailer who has converted a landmark ice hockey stadium into a flagship store that reconnects with quality retail. There are also recipes for a cosy dinner and recipes for business success courtesy of a Paris meets New York publisher. The April issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
With bureaus in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York and Zurich, and over 25 correspondents around the world, Monocle has an experienced team of editors and journalists filing for us around the clock. From our bureau in Tokyo, Kenji Hall covers Japan and beyond.
I've kicked the tires of the Taiwanese president's motorcade, and in the span of just a couple of weeks, I've swung through more than a dozen cities across Japan, from Hiroshima to Sapporo, for Monocle's Japan Guide. The best part, though, is that I get to live in Tokyo. There's really no better city to get lost in and to mingle with world-class architects, artists, and artisans. It's a city where food and fashion are a religion, where designers like Naoto Fukasawa turn everyday products into art.
That was Monocle's Kenji Hall, our man in Tokyo.
And welcome back to The Review. It's Saturday here in London. And you're with me, Tyler Brulé and Hugo MacDonald.
Every Saturday here on The Review in Midori House, we pick some of our favourite magazine titles to rifle through. And to help us dissect them, we're joined in the studio by Lucia Vanderpost, founding editor and associate editor of the FT's How to Spend It magazine. Welcome, Lucia.
Lovely to be here. Thank you very much
for coming in on a Saturday morning. We've got a pile of magazines each.
We do. I'm going to pass some more across to you as well, some that we like. But I guess a lot of the big news in London this week has been the launch of yet another magazine with a life suffix at the end of it. And The Spectator, much loved weekly in this country and in many other markets. Spectator Life had a bit of a bash and a launch this week. And I see it in front of you, Hugo. And Lucia, you have it. What do you make of it?
Well, I've been a lifelong Spectator reader. I love The Spectator. And I suppose it caused me to start thinking, why would I buy another magazine? What is it that would make me buy it? And I came to the conclusion that the things I love in magazines are things that tell me things I don't already know. And that's quite difficult to do. And this has succeeded in one or two areas. Then I buy them for beauty, if they really are just... I mean, I love looking through, for instance, World of Interiors, because I'm just gobsmacked by the beauty. And then I suppose that there are the magazines that give one essential information.
Mm.
And I don't quite know what Spectator... It seems to me a little bit of a mishmash to me. There were things that interested me. I mean, I was very interested to read about this new writer who I'd never heard of, which I always think is part of the job of a magazine, is to introduce one to new thoughts, ideas, writers. So I was very interested in this interview with Jacob Hailbrum. Had you heard of him?
I hadn't. And actually, I'm glad you picked up on that, because that was one of the only things that I liked about him.
It really was interesting to me, and that thing of the... I mean, I'm not fantastically interested in sports, but I could see that this was actually a novel I might read.
Yeah. No, I agree. I feel... I mean, I don't know what you think about the cover, for instance, which is... I mean, it seems like something that... I mean, it's been designed by Hugh Cushar, who is a London-based graphic designer. It looks quite like Port, which he also designed.
Mm.
Not particularly inspiring, I didn't think.
No, and I think that was the first thing you thought of was Port.
Yeah.
And that I wouldn't have been particularly thrilled if I was the publisher. just go, I mean, oddly though, what's interesting is when you look at the cover though, it I think overpromises in a way.
Definitely.
Because when you get inside, there was an enormous budget for original art. Most of it looks like it's been pickup art to me. But I think Lucia, maybe your post, you know, your point as well, when you look at something like World of Interiors, I mean, part of what you love about it is that everything, they're taking you into a place where everything is specially commissioned. They haven't gone to a syndication agency to go and, you know, buy three spreads. And that's the delight of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you see, I quite liked the cover because I thought, this isn't going to be just sort of light tosh. There's going to be a bit of weight to it, sort of that black and white and the black and white photograph. I quite liked it. But I didn't think it fully delivered on, as you said, on that particular promise. I mean, the other piece I did really like was Alain de Botton. I suppose I've got to the kind of age where I like reading people who think as I think. And I loved his, not too many challenges. I mean, I loved his take of how beauty really matters in life. I mean, it's something that I believe in passionately, which is why I've been writing about beautiful things all my life. And where he says here, which it was a thought that sort of has been swilling around, but I've never seen it articulated so clearly, when he talks about the need for good architecture ultimately gets ignored because it isn't recognised for what it really is, a mental health issue. Mm. And that's actually quite profound and I think very true.
Absolutely.
So I like that piece a lot.
Yes.
Hugo, this is a story, and we've been talking to Alain about this, and he's been doing some things for us as well. Did you feel, though, that they were late to the party?
Absolutely.
With this?
I think, I mean, what Lucia says is so true, that Alain can put into words what very few other journalists are able to do in terms of translating, particularly architecture, which I think a lot of people get a little bit scared at the idea of reading an article or a magazine about architecture. Alain manages to make it human. But the story, I think, on, well, first of all, on his Living Architecture project, which has been going on for sort of 2 years, and there's been so much coverage of that, but also on his sort of thoughts on faith and architecture. Everybody was doing that sort of 2 months ago, weren't they?
Well, maybe if not sooner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a lovely, it's a very, very good and well-written piece, but as a cover story, and a big story on the inside, I sort of picked it up and thought, oh, no, that's, you know, it's a bit late. They could have maybe tried a little bit harder.
Should we move to, literally, you brought in the current issue of World of Interiors with you. Here's a title at a time, and I think it has a number of things going for it, because it's unique, because it's owned by Condé Nast. It wasn't started by Condé Nast. Condé Nast acquired this magazine. But it's quite amazing that they have not chosen to do the Brazilian edition. They haven't, you know, they haven't gone down the path of doing a US edition. Do you think it's a unique invention to London as a publishing brand?
Well, I think that that is one of the things I love about it, that there is something quintessentially English about it. It isn't pretending to be global. And I love that. It comes from a very specific point of view. I always remember T.S. Eliot's remark where he said that of any literature, that the more it was precisely the provincial, the more it could aspire to universality. And I feel that about World of Interiors. It is quintessentially English, even when it looks at, as it often does, at design abroad. I mean, one of the things that I picked up on, because I come from South Africa, as may be well known, and there is, you can hear it in my voice, there is a piece on a beautifully photographed piece on a very simple house in Kenya. And that did inspire me quite a lot, but it also made me reflect on the fact of how much wonderful design is coming out of Africa at the moment, particularly South Africa, where that whole amalgam of all these glorious tribes and such a complicated, complex, rich history is somehow going through some kind of melting pot, and glorious things are coming out. And I'm hoping that we'll see a lot more wonderful things coming out of Africa.
Does a magazine like World of Interiors become even more relevant today because it just sticks to the knitting. It continues to do what it's always done. And as a result, it almost defines itself even more because everyone is trying to do 1,000 other things with their publishing brands. And the fact that they just, it seems almost very sort of
airtight. They do very well and it's sort of untouchable.
But also it's always inspiring, isn't it? I mean, they're always, and somehow the new things that which they do in, for instance, something like Antenne Roundup, I mean, that's something that every magazine does, but they do it very well and they're always lovely things. I just think that, as you say, it knows what it's about. It knows what it's for. Mm. I always think that's so essential, whether it's a shop or a magazine. You must know what you're for. And you get the feeling that World of Interiors is very confident and knows precisely what it's for.
Exactly. And I have friends who have worked there and work there now, and it's such an endless education. Like, they really work so hard to understand everything from paint brands and the way that they're sort of made. And it's not just a sort of picking things off press releases.
Right.
You know, they learn the skills.
So there's a real rigour.
Such a rigour. And, I mean, they're sort of devoted to it and to Rupert Thomas. And
I mean, do either of you get a sense of how much pitching there is there versus true research on the part of the editors? Because that's one thing I've never... And maybe that's the thing I like about World of Interiors. I have no sense of how it functions.
Exactly.
And it's, I think that's so delightful. Because sometimes you think, oh, I understand the mechanics of that magazine. Yeah. I know the evolution of that press release. And of course, we're closer to things maybe here. But I think that's what's wonderful about it. So either of you have any sense of how it kind of functions as an operation? Is it really Rupert just saying, I've met lovely people at a dinner party and we're going to go and do this house in Kenya. Is that how it works? Or do you think it's also photographers coming to them saying, something's been pitched to me?
There's a lot of, I think, people coming and pitching, but it's always done with proper integrity. It's not.
Sure.
And rigorously sifted. And
exactly. Yeah. I think the sheer volume that they get through to get what they put in each issue is enormous. It sort of functions not unlike how we do Monocle upstairs, but just in a much more...
But also, I'd like to pick up on that point you said about education. I always learn something from it.
Yeah,
you know, from one's... I mean, here's a thing on classical revival, the multi-talented André Arbus. You know, I've learned quite a lot from that, which I didn't know before. I knew a bit.
Yeah.
And I always love to come away knowing and having learnt something more. I had a glimpse into a world I didn't know about.
One of my friends was doing a story on materials for them, and rather than just sort of getting pictures of the materials or having the materials photographed, he spent about 2 weeks sewing materials in the shape of sweets, and they did this very sort of interesting creative shoot where it was materials turned into giant hard-boiled sweets and, you know, lots of pinpricks later. An amazing creative effort that had gone into it, and the story... You could really see them, and the fact that they put so much effort into doing something different.
Because someone could have attempted to have done that in Photoshop.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
On the cheap.
But no, I know, completely. I think I'm a huge fan of the World of Interiors.
Alicia, how important is collectability to you? Does a good magazine have to go back up on the shelf? Or is there also a certain delight in also the temporary nature of magazines as well, that they can go into a bin bag too?
Well, in theory, I mean, I keep reading about people who have every copy, you know, fashion mad people who have every copy of Vogue that since they were born virtually. I don't know where they put them. I don't know where they live. It's, you know, in theory, I rather like the idea of having this wonderful, wonderful archive. But I mean, I live in a 5-story London house and I don't have room. I mean, I have to come kind of cowl.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I just wouldn't have room. If you saw my study, it's already overflowing. So I collect very few. I mean, right. I'd say very few issues.
Mm. You've brought Vaughan Review from Switzerland with you.
I went to... Well, I was in Copenhagen in October and I met the editor of Vaughan Review, who's a lovely woman called Lena Numa. And she was telling me all about the redesign that they'd done, and I'm ashamed to say I wasn't familiar with it before. But here I've brought in a couple of old copies.
Oh,
it's Swiss.
Yes, and it's been through an overhaul. It has a cover which is not unlike Fantastic Man. It's
exactly
that same white clean. Yeah, it's that same. There's the same finish on the cover, but you know, it has gone through because it was quite. It's quite chilly before.
Was it? Okay, yeah, well, I still quite like the fact that there is still something chilly about it.
Well, it's Switzerland.
I know, and this is what I'm attracted to.
And I do mean sort of, you know, it's Switzerland in the sense that I always think the Swiss are very, very good at architecture. And if they stick to what they do best, which is sort of the Alpine Hütte, then it's good.
Mm.
But they, you know, we've talked about it before here. Sometimes you go into the most incredible buildings and they're so cold.
Yeah.
just and often it's, I think it's because they leave it to the architect to do the interiors.
Yeah.
And I'm not always a huge fan.
That's so funny that you say that, because the other thing I love about Swiss magazines is the advertising and the tiny little brands for all the hardware
that's
that you would
incredible.
Have in your homes.
Yeah.
That you have never heard of, these specialist locksmiths and specialist sort of window makers, door handles. They all advertise in all the Swiss magazines. And aren't interested in expanding anywhere outside the Swiss market.
Mm.
So I tried to get in touch with them to find out a little bit more about these companies, and did they have a story to them, which you're sure they always must do.
At first glance, Lucia, what do you make of that?
It does look a little austere for my taste. and, of course, not being able to read the text, sadly, as it's all in German, I can't tell how... informative, lively, or rigorous the text is. It looks as if it would be primarily of interest to the architectural and the design industry. It looks very professional. I'm quite glad to see a few little sort of quirky decorative things creeping in, but not a lot. Here we have some pressed glass plates.
Yes.
And right at the front, there's something wonderfully quirky called Trashig. Is this from a sort of Trash Luxe? Kind of.
Yes, it looks like it. Is that the cologne? Oh, no, I've got cologne on here. Fair roundup.
Which does look... I like a bit of wit and fantasy, I'm afraid. I'm not anti-decorative at all.
Too so Swiss and cold.
A little bit for me. I remember the first time I was in Zurich and my father said, "Now, darling, go and buy yourself a dress, anything you like." And there was nothing. It was so boring. It's a long time ago now.
You're getting the same sensation from Woan Review.
No, it's very classy in its way.
Yeah.
But it doesn't warm the cockles of my heart like World of Interiors.
No.
Tyler, you've brought some magazines in which are a little bit further afield.
Yeah, a little bit further afield. I'm just leaning across, because this was something I picked up in Japan called Corner, and it's a journal of runner's lifestyle. And I do run. I was running this morning around Regent's Park. I'm going to have a rant in a moment, because we've had a spate of muggings around here, Lucia, around our offices. Kids on scooters who are like knocking phones out of, the hands of our staff. I was talking to people from a Nordic embassy nearby. They've had sort of three muggings, same type of thing happening. So anyway, as I was doing my run, I had to go and talk to the diplomatic police in front of the US embassy. I'm a runner. I didn't solve the crime and how we're going to tackle this particular issue. But as soon as I get off air, I'm going to go and talk to the people down at our local police station. Anyway, I was in Tokyo 2 weeks ago, and this was launched and unveiled at Tsutaya Books. And I think runners' magazines have not reinvented themselves since sort of the boom of the 1970s. It's always sort of the same sort of, five things, how you can sort of, improve your speed and all of these types of things. And this is... they've mostly shot this in Hugo's favorite city and in and around San Francisco. But they've just kind of done this day in the life of people who, and it's the running routine.
It's running and lifestyle,
and,
isn't it?
And what they wear. Mm. But I think there's a bigger call to action also to... Because I thought... I'm just going to be in the studio with you this morning. And I thought, should I just, shuffle into the office, or should I go for a run this morning? Mm-hmm. And you want something which is motivational. And I think to be able to give you that sort of overlay, as opposed to just showing that, yes, I should sort of, eat a banana before I go. And we all kind of know that now.
Yeah.
And I think you sort of have to move
on. Or
how
to warm up or warm down. But
it
just seems
like
very
it.
Indulgent. I don't really get anything new
from
it.
Well, running is indulgent as well, because you have to make time to go and do it.
I know, but how will they be able, 15 issues down the line with Corner?
Just give it time.
Okay.
People say the same thing about our magazine. But you did like this one, Terroir.
I love that. So this is from Singapore.
This is from Singapore. I like that. I love the binding, that they didn't put a proper spine on this.
But the paper is so beautiful.
But let's talk more about Corner. We'll come back to that. Lucia, what do you make of that?
Well, I'm not at all familiar with running magazines. So.
Me neither.
And it's mostly in Japanese. But to me, this looks fun. I don't run. I wish I did. I'd be a lot thinner if I did. But I may take it up. But this looks fun. It looks as if it's kind of running integrated in a whole way of life, not just,
Exactly.
But you're much more familiar with the genre, and you think this offers something new.
I think it's totally... I love the format, too.
Yeah, I did, too.
It's just very bookish.
Nice to feel. Yeah, like a book. Yeah.
Absolutely. Maybe pass that one across. This is a labour of love from someone in Singapore, but I just like the fact that it's...
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, this is, Hugo, maybe you can describe.
It has an artisanal feeling, doesn't it?
It feels like it's been made by hand. Mm. And
lovingly.
What is actually really nice is if you look at the masthead and the photos, the art direction, the words, all from this one man whose name I can't remember. Mr. Coe?
Yeah, I think so. Yes,
Singaporean.
Yes.
And it's his sort of dream travel.
And he's printing every section himself as well.
Reading.
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me at all. It's beautiful. It has a lovely paper stock.
Do you think, Lucia, that publishing heads more in this direction, you know, when in the midst of this great digital versus print debate, that we're going to go into much more of a crafted territory like this?
I can't help feeling that they will have to, because if it's USP is just information, you can get that perfectly well on the web. Indeed better, because it's faster and more up to date. And I think that they have to offer something a lot more. And to return to Alain de Botton, beauty is something that appeals to everybody. I think this is lovely. And also, I like things that are very particular, you know, that aren't trying to appeal to everybody. He's done what he loves, you feel here. And he hopes you love it too, but if you don't, can't
be. Then it's not for you, and it's not trying to please everyone the whole time, which is the huge problem.
Exactly.
I'm so glad you said
that. Lucia, thank you very much for coming in on a Saturday. Great to see you.
Not at all. Great
fun.
And
let's go have a coffee or something now. That brings us to the end of today's edition of The Review. For now, it's a goodbye from all of us. Today's show is produced by Dawn Trump. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And our sound engineer was Alex Funnell. You can catch up with the best of the week stories with Sophie Grove on The Curator, which is up next. And don't forget to tune into The Monocle Weekly, which is going to be on air tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. But for now, from all of us here in London, that's me, Tyler Brulé,
Hugo MacDonald,
it's goodbye and have a very good weekend. Goodbye.